The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about whether we're in the middle of a mass extinction. First, Dave, what qualifies as a mass extinction?
Well, Rob, there have been 5 mass extinctions in the history of Earth, and scientists usually define these extinctions by the fact that 3/4 of all species vanish, and vanish relatively quickly. And 3/4 of all species sounds like a lot, and how could that be happening right now? But actually, conservationists have been arguing for a while that because of climate change, because of human encroachment on other species' habitat, because of invasive species, also largely due to humans, that we're in the middle of a 6th mass extinction. And the thing that would distinguish this mass extinction from all the other ones, say the one that wiped out the dinosaurs about 65 million years ago, which was caused by an asteroid, or at least that's the hypothesis, that this current mass extinction was caused by none other than human beings.
So it's over the course of hundreds or thousands of years.
Well, that's the idea. And that's what researchers wanted to find out in this study. They wanted to see, are we really in the process of losing this many species? And to find that out, they went back to the fossil record and they looked specifically at mammals. And the reason they looked at mammals is because mammals are very well represented in the fossil record, and therefore they give very solid numbers. And what they found was that the average rate of mammal extinction is about 2 species for every million years. But when they looked back in the past 500 years, 80 species out of the 5,570 species of mammals that are known had gone extinct. And that's a rate of species loss that exceeds what scientists have seen in previous mass extinctions. Now, the scientists didn't just look at mammals. They also looked at amphibians and reptiles and birds and plants. And for all these, they were seeing these dramatic species losses in recent history. The current extinction rate, they feel, is about 3 to 80 times higher than it should be if species were just going extinct at a normal level. And they said all this adds up to the fact that we are at the beginning of another mass extinction, what some have called this 6th great mass extinction, and that potentially, according to their calculations, within the next 300 years or so, 75% of all mammal species will be gone. So imagine looking out your window and seeing 3/4 fewer mammals than you see now.
Now, you said a lot of this was predicated on human causes, so it's not inevitable then that this will happen.
Well, that remains up in the air. What the scientists do say is that there are things we can do to at least slow this extinction. The big dramatic finding out of this study is not only that so many species are going extinct, but that they'll go extinct in such a short frame of time, just a few hundred years. And what the scientists say, if we really become more proactive about protecting endangered species and protecting habitats, we might be able to slow this rate of extinction so it doesn't happen over 300 years. Maybe it happens over thousands of years. Now, chances are a lot of this is still going to happen, but there may be a way to at least prolong the inevitable.
Okay, well, grim news, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, speaking of extinctions and creatures that have gone extinct, this next story is about dinosaurs and how they may have actually influenced the evolution of pine cones.
In what way?
Well, Rob, it turns out that today's pine cones, and these are the seed carriers that are produced by conifer trees, and this includes cypresses and Douglas fir and giant redwoods, that there is a difference between the male and the female cones. The male cones, which release the pollen, and the female cones that house the seeds, the male cones tend to be slender, and the female cones tend to be bulky, and they're largely bulky because they have these almost sort of spike-like projections. But the female cones didn't always look this way. The scientists in this study went back and looked at some museum collections and noticed that the female pine cones used to be a lot slimmer. They actually used to look very much like today's male pine cones. And you can see some pictures of these guys on the site. And so he began to wonder, well, why have female pine cones bulked up so much?
And dinosaurs was the conclusion?
Dinosaurs is his leading theory, and here's the reason why. When he went back to his museum collections, he noticed that the female pine cones started to bulk up in the Jurassic period. This is a time when large vertebrate herbivores, such as the long-necked sauropods, were roaming the earth. And the reason that's significant is because you can imagine a lot of these pine cones are really high up in the trees, and they theoretically don't have a lot of animals that can feed on them up there. Most of these animals around the time are really grazing on the ground. And all of a sudden, at least in geological terms, these sauropods come along and they've got these very long necks. And instead of just having animals that graze along the ground, now you've got these animals with these really long necks that can reach up to 5 meters up into a tree. And so now you've got these female pine cones that are suddenly very vulnerable to being eaten. They weren't vulnerable to being eaten before. And so the idea is that they adapted, they became a lot bulkier, a lot spikier, that made them less attractive objects to eat. And that's why we have today's big, bulky female pine cones.
5 meters doesn't seem all that tall compared to a tree, Dave.
Well, Rob, 5 meters is the height that the sauropod head would have been. Scientists still aren't sure whether the sauropods could actually lift their necks up like giraffes. And if so, they could have gotten even higher into the trees. But the idea is that even at 5 meters, these female cones would have been a lot more vulnerable than they had been previously.
Could other species have contributed too?
Well, yes, it's not just dinosaurs that may be to blame. Around this time, insects were also evolving different features. In fact, there was an increase in different types of insect mouth parts, and that could have also been a selective pressure on these pine cones, as well as birds. Birds were just starting to appear around this time, and they could have also, you can imagine, they can get really high up into trees. And so there's a lot of species that potentially could have contributed to this bulking up of female pine cones. But as far as I'm concerned, Rob, the next time I step on a big, spiky pine cone, I'm going to blame a dinosaur.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from the evolving pine cone to the evolving eye, this last story is about how African scenery may have influenced the evolution of our eyes.
So something that we actually saw was in some ways selective pressure for the evolution of our eye?
That's the idea. The study deals with these cone cells in our eye, and we have this whole array of light-sensitive cone cells. Some respond to red, some respond to blue, some respond to green light, and these all combine to give us our color vision. And on a lot of animals, researchers have noticed that these cone cells are arranged in a very specific way. For example, the retinas of fish that live at different depths of a lake have different patterns of cone cells in different parts of their eyes because they're arranged in such a way that they respond to very specific wavelengths of light. And fish that are much deeper in the lake would have to be able to see in one wavelength of light, while those that are much shallower would want to see in another wavelength of light. And the researchers call this the efficient coding hypothesis. The idea is that our eyes, like the rest of our body, are very well adapted to our environment. But the efficient coding hypothesis seems to run into trouble when it comes to human eyes. They don't seem like they're very efficiently coded. And the reason is because if you can imagine the things we see every day, what's one of the biggest things we see every day? It's the sky, right? And that's a blue sky. A lot of us also see the ocean every day. So blue is a very important color to us, and yet only about 6% of our cone cells detect blue, and they're really located around the edge of our retina, so they're not very central to the eye. And so that seems kind of confusing. Why, if blue is such an important color to our environment, do we have so few cone cells that respond to this color? And the other thing is that the ratio of red and green cones that we have is really random between individuals. Some individuals have more of one or the other, and if this is a very sort of tightly selected arrangement that's evolved over millions of years, why do people seem to have these random arrangements of red and green cones? So in this new study, the scientists tried to figure out, okay, is there a sort of a method behind the madness of our eyes, or do they really just not fit this efficient coding hypothesis?
And so they went to look at landscapes in Africa?
They did. And the reason they chose Africa, and specifically they chose Botswana, is this is a place where a lot of primates currently live and where humans are thought to have evolved. So this is an environment that our ancestors would have begun to adapt to about 10 million years ago. And the researchers created a database of more than 5,000 high-resolution photographs of this environment, taken at various places in Botswana at various times of day, various different exposure levels. They just really wanted to capture the entire range of scenery and colors that a creature growing up in this environment would have been exposed to. And what they found was that when they compared the types of wavelengths of light that these scenes would have given off to the arrangement of the cone cells in our eye, the arrangement of cone cells in our eye suddenly began to make a lot more sense. They found, for example, that our red and green cones would pick up a lot more of the photons from these images than would blue cones, and that would explain why we have so few blue cone cells. And they also found that the red and green cones in our eyes would pick up about the same amount of information whether they were red or green cones, and that's probably why it doesn't matter what our ratio of of red to green cones is and why some people have different ratios than others. It just matters that we have the same total amount. The arrangement doesn't really make a difference. And so all this seems to indicate that they actually do seem to be very well adapted to our environment, or at least the environment we evolved in.
So our ancestors weren't looking at the sky, the idea is, as much as we do today. They're not cutting down trees.
That's possible. And it's also possible that there was just so many other colors in their environment that were even more important than looking at the sky, you know, especially if they were in a heavily forested area or if there was a lot of grassland or whatever. There may have been colors that were a lot more important to them than just the color of the sky.
So an interesting hypothesis. What, if any, applications are there?
Well, one interesting application is for designing machines that actually see a lot better than current robots do. Engineers wanted to develop these robots that are very good at facial recognition or recognizing new objects that they have never seen before. The problem with that is the way that machines usually do that right now is they just have a database of objects, and then they quote-unquote see something, they compare it to that database, and they try to determine what it is. But what if they see something they've never seen before? How do they adapt to these new visions? And the idea is if we can sort of structure machine vision around this efficient coding hypothesis, we could create machines with smarter eyes that would be able to see the world much like we do.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about a very gross creature known as the hagfish. And it turns out this creature is even grosser than we thought. It's a marine creature that feeds on the corpses of other animals, but it turns out it also absorbs these corpses through its skin. So a pretty gross story there. Also a story about why some people sleep a lot deeper than others. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got new developments with the budget in the United States. There's been a lot of wrangling about what to cut and what to save, and what the most recent thoughts are about the impact it will have on science in the U.S. And also a story about global clinical trials, trying to make these trials more ethical than they have been. The U.S. government has just set up a bioethics panel to review some of these trials to make sure some of the mistakes that were made in the past aren't made again. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.